Geekily Yoked is a proud member of the Crossover Nexus. To find more blogs and podcasts about the intersection of faith and pop culture, check out crossovernexus.com. Tell them Bilbo sent you.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekly Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I am a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto with a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
I'm a stay-at-home dad who spends most of his time trying to think up witty Facebook quotes, which makes me a giant dork.
It really does. That's pretty sad, Lehman.
Well, we were on the drive with a baby and we couldn't make any noise, and so I just sat there and all I could think of...
Composing Facebook just, status updates?
Just in my head, like small poems. Rachel and I just got back from a bit of a road trip, but before we get into that, I just wanted to make note of what you guys heard at the top of the show. We are, we've been a part of this group of Christian geek podcasters, Christian pop cultural podcasters, I should say. They may not want to identify as geek.
Who would want to identify as being a geek?
But we're all now official. We are the Crossover Nexus. We're a nice, fun group of folks. We actually had celebrated our big launching off with a roundtable discussion talking about biblical adaptations. We had a lot of thoughts about Left Behind. Sadly, Rachel was not a part of that, but hopefully she'll be around for future editions. Check out crossovernexus.com and you'll be hearing lots of stuff from us about that. So, car
trip. Road trip? Yes.
Yeah.
With a baby. She did a good job.
She did a very good job. She slept at all.
At all, which is more than I really expected.
I really wasn't expecting. I was just expecting lots of screaming.
Or rather, I was thinking she might sleep for like an hour, but be awake at 5 o'clock every morning.
Oh, that is true. No, she slept at night really well.
Yeah.
It was the car that I was just expecting to be just like...
Misery?
A scream fest the entire time.
No, it was all things considered, it was not soul-crushing and terrible.
And we didn't have to listen to All Things Considered on NPR to put her to sleep, which was at one point a plan.
Was it?
No.
Oh. I thought we just discovered that, like, the lilting sounds of our conversation put her to sleep.
I do feel like when we try to be very silent and still was when we got the most fuss, and when we were just, like, jabbering on about nothing was when we'd look over and be like, oh, she's asleep.
She went to sleep, yes. Already bored by her parents.
Yeah.
But we had a fun time at our 10-year college reunion.
Yeah, well, we missed our 5-year, but we went and got
our... We missed our 5-year because I was trapped in CPE.
You were helping people in CPE.
Was I? Was I really? Wasn't I just, like, chasing them down going, I need to care for you pastorally so I can fill out my time card.
Would you like to explain to people what CPE is?
Clinical Pastoral Education?
And this is something that sort of goes across all...
It's a thing.
It's a huge thing. It's funny because I'll see, you know,
I think it tends to be disproportionately full of Anglicans because we are required to do it for ordination.
Oh, I see, okay.
Whereas many other denominations might not be.
Because my brother went through it, and so I heard about it from him, and then one of my, like, rabbi friends is going through it.
Well, my dad did it.
So it certainly cuts across a lot of lines and seems to be a place of sadness.
It's fine to have experience in a hospital or some form of clinical setting to do real pastoral work.
But it seems useful.
Yes, but that's only half of the time, and the rest of the time you're trapped in a group with 5 other people, like, amateur psychoanalyzing each other.
Oh, that's
and
true.
And navel-gazing and, like, making each other cry.
Because, like, all the sort of, like, administrative bureaucracy, I feel like that was also preparing you for a life of ministry.
It
was the sort of intense summer camp experience that was expected from you.
Yeah, well, and it was because the unit that I did didn't... Usually in CPE, you have to have overnight stays at the hospital.
Oh, right.
Like, you're on call overnight. But our hospital wasn't set up for that, weirdly. So, like, rather than doing overnight on calls, we had to do these, like, weird 5-hour shifts after the normal working day.
It was really weird.
And because we weren't just, like, on call, we had to account for all of that time.
Yeah.
So it really did result in us, like, wandering around the hospital.
Anyone grieving?
Yeah. Like, I would just lurk around, like, the ER and chat with people who were waiting to get seen in the ER.
See? Providing...
Which, you know... It's something
valuable,
but anyway, that was why we didn't go to our 5-year reunion.
But we went to our 10-year.
Yes,
and we sat around playing apples to apples because that's the best way to recapture our college experience.
It's true.
It was not the giant 30-person game that we had, I think, like the year after we graduated.
Yes, that was when we went back the year after. Anyway, but it was lovely to see people and to see Gambier, Ohio.
That's right. We got to see some Amish. Amanda got to see some Amish.
Amanda did get to see some Amish, which was nice. She had experience.
She didn't get yelled at by street preachers, so.
No. That when the local community decided that our liberal arts college needed to get saved.
Except for me, because I'm a missionary kid, so I was given a free pass.
But it was just one of, I remember sitting there with one of our, I think our friend Rachel, who listens to this podcast, and the two of us were standing there on the street, like, watching the really obnoxious street preacher, and then watching the really obnoxious, like, philosophy major or college students, and just, like, all of them obnoxiously yelling at each other. And we're like, can just God just smite that whole circle right there. That would be great.
Sudden sinkhole.
But then there were Jerry and Joe, who were like the nice evangelists who came to bring cookies during finals and stuff.
They preached hellfire and damnation in a sort of charming, bearded way.
They were polite about it.
Sort of in that nice Mennonite manner.
It's true.
And that was our trip. And now we're back in Toronto.
Oh, and then family.
Oh, right. There was family.
Amanda got to meet her great-great-grandparents.
She did.
And hear all about her great-great-grandparents.
That was actually pretty exciting.
That was really cool.
That was very nice.
Family. So because of last week's, or not last week, I suppose, but last time,
yes,
our podcast with Doug Jones, which if you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to that episode.
Seriously, we had like a genuine celebrity. He was willing to speak with us.
It was pretty awesome. Like, it was pretty awesome.
I don't know how we're going to top that. Probably we won't.
No, we won't. But
when we get Carmen.
But you got to meet Gina Torres.
I did get to meet Gina Torres. She was not on the podcast. I did not put a camera or microphone in her face.
If you could not even photograph her with my child.
I'm not going to just hand a baby
See,
to her.
Okay. Dear tiny, tiny listening audience that we have, do you not think that it is unfortunate that Lehman met Gina Torres at our local Starbucks and did not say, please let me get a picture of you holding this baby because it would make my wife's, like,
We had a genuine interaction where she was sort of talking to Amanda and cooing at her, and she was in line, and, like, I'm not going to be like, hey, you've been on the TV, let me take advantage of you.
All I'm saying is, I think Gina Torres probably has a small enough fan base that she doesn't get recognized all the time.
Do you want me to get her on the show? Would that make it up for you?
I should say, all I'm saying is that I can't promise I won't be stalking her at that Starbucks from now on.
No, that's fair enough.
But this does bring us to our topic for today.
That's right. From time to time, you've probably heard us use a bizarre little phrase called CanCon.
Canadian content.
Because of the sort of, I don't know, ubiquity of American cultural hegemony, Canada at some point decided that a certain percentage of everything put on Canadian airwaves had to originate in Canada or somehow define Canadian, like, qualities. I was hearing a great interview with Rick Moranis where he's talked about how that's how the characters of Doug and Bob McKenzie were born on SCTV.
Oh, really?
Was that they were told, we need more Canadian content, and so as a joke, they're like, we're just going to make two dumb Canadian guys who just sit around and drink beer and talk about hockey, and that became the most popular, iconic image, both for that show and kind of for Canada.
Wow.
It was born out of sort of snarky rebelliousness, which really does say something about Canada.
I suppose.
But we want to get to something even more specific and
parochial.
Well, because
CanCon is just like a huge thing that we don't, and it's not particularly geeky, it's just a thing that exists and is usually kind of sad.
Yeah. No, it's a miasma that things sort of, you know, live in here. But what's really relevant to our interests and to our specific location is what we are dubbing either ToroCon or T-Con.
I like T-Con.
The same notion of Toronto content.
Yeah.
Torontent? That doesn't really work.
That doesn't really work.
And really what we're looking at here are shows that are...
And this could just be a symptom of the fact that the rest of Canada already thinks that Toronto thinks it's the center of the universe.
Yeah.
We've just excised the rest of Canada and are only talking about Toronto.
Well, we'll get to Vancouver and Newfoundland.
X-Files.
One day, sure.
Yes.
But the idea here is we wanted to look at shows that have been made in Toronto that are obviously filmed in Toronto.
And there are varying degrees of trying to hide or not the fact that they are filmed in Toronto.
That is the best. And then we're going to focus on a couple of shows in general that not only are filmed here, but managed to, like, just capture something really
Toronto-y?
Just, yeah, they're Torontonian without necessarily being about Toronto. Like, yeah. we have yet to see the you know, the Rob and Doug Ford TV. Well, okay, no, that's not true. They did have a TV show.
They did have a TV show.
We've yet
show,
to see the,
unfortunately.
Like, we've yet to see, you know, some, I guess in like 10 years or so, we'll have like the, yes, wacky comedy about their time in, yes, office. Although, you know, they did actually in Vancouver, once again, Vancouver had a very popular, like, police, I can't remember what it was, like, forensics guy, and they had a show about him. And then when that guy, that actual guy, became mayor, they had the sort of fictionalized,
oh my goodness,
version become mayor. So, like, that could happen here.
Okay.
We could see the Ford brothers.
I would be happy just to see them swept under the rug.
I don't think that's going to happen, Rachel.
Anyway.
I think they're an institution.
So.
Toronto.
Can we start with the Mountie show? Because it's the best.
We can start with the Mountie show. Well, first you have to understand that Toronto is nice because it's a big city. You know, you've got sort of big skyscrapers.
But it's not like New York big.
Well, it's not New York busy.
No.
And I don't think it's New York expensive.
But I kind of like our little Dundas Square, which is like really sad wannabe Times Square.
It's fair.
I love Dundas Square.
They have very nice things
it's
that
so,
go on there.
It's so pathetic.
But the big thing is that
it's
you,
so cute.
Is that with Toronto, you can like cut off traffic in places and sort,
I guess,
of
that's true, yeah,
section off huge chunks of the city, and you really haven't inconvenience people too much. And if they are inconvenienced, they're Canadian, so, you know, chances are they're nicer about it. But yeah, so huge chunks will just be, we, you know, take it off, like university buildings. We have a lot of old looking buildings that get used for period shows, and also
Wycliffe College, my seminary.
That's right.
They filmed a
John
CBC,
McDonald.
Yeah, John A. McDonald. There was a like
biopic.
Yes.
And he had something that looked sort of 1860s-ish.
Yeah.
And we've seen university in a lot of places. We've seen certain hotels used over and over and over again. The bookstore that I worked in was filmed for an episode of Suits.
Suits tries to make the Royal York Hotel into so many things.
It's,
and what I don't understand is not only do they try to make the Royal York Hotel so many things, they don't even hide. They don't even disguise the giant
features.
Clock in the center, which is its most prominent feature.
Yeah. So lots of stuff have been filmed here, and including Fraggle Rock, we just discovered.
Yes.
But yes, let's start with the Mountie show.
So the Mountie show,
not its actual name,
not its actual name, just its name in spirit, is the story of Benton Fraser, who, oh, what's his line in the fourth season that he always says? I came to Chicago to track down my father's killer, and for reasons that don't bear explaining now, I've remained indefinitely attached as a liaison to the Canadian consulate.
Paul Gross is this bizarre, like, actor/country music singer who has had a very strange career.
Very strange career, including Men with Brooms, the curling movie with Leslie Nielsen.
Yes, Leslie Nielsen in a beard. Which...
And Passchendaele, the World War I movie about the, like, Canadian soldiers.
Yep, and he was in some Western about a cowboy who refused to use a gun.
He's had this, like, definitively Canadian career.
Well, he was on an incredibly well-respected show called
Slings and Arrows.
Slings and Arrows, which was just a huge sort of send-up of...
It wasn't even just a send-up of actors. It was a send-up specifically of actors at the Stratford, Ontario.
No, precisely. Of a very specific kind of, yeah, festival Canadian theater.
I mean, if you want to talk CanCon,
yeah.
Paul Gross is just like...
And I've got to meet him on multiple occasions.
He has purchased books from you.
Yes, he's come to my book. He came to my bookstore many, many times, and I got to see him. And the last time I saw him, he had very interesting kind of frosted blonde hair.
Weird.
But yes,
anyway, so he had this show back in the 90s that kind of began as a fairly earnest cop show, albeit strange.
Well, it was one of those do-gooder shows from the 90s.
It was the
right?
90s do-gooder show.
It's the story of a paladin, you know, coming into Chicago.
Coming into Chicago, hooking up with, like, a tough-talking, wise-cracking Chicago detective. And the two of them, because he is on the trail of his father's murderer. And so he gets himself reassigned down to Chicago. And it's just, it's so bizarre and peculiar. And he is like every Canadian stereotype embodied in one person. So it's kind of like an odd couple, buddy cop drama. But it just got progressively weirder.
Yeah.
Like, in the first season, it was like a fairly earnest, albeit do-goodery show. And then by like halfway through the first season, they established the presence of his father's ghost, as played by Canadian icon Gordon Pinchot.
Yes.
Which, by the way, we should include this link in the show notes.
Oh, the Justin Bieber?
Yes, Gordon Pinchot reading Justin Bieber's autobiography.
Oh, dearie dear. Okay, great. Fair enough.
It'll be in the show notes. And his deaf wolf that reads lips named Diefenbaker.
Yes. Also, we should point out that Chicago apparently has streetcars and Canadian Post
boxes. Yeah. Yes. This falls very heavily on the side of not even trying to disguise Toronto.
Oh, boy.
There's a whole episode that shot at Knox College at the U of T. There was an episode where they're on the steps of the University of Toronto bookstore, which was right across the street of where I used to live. Yeah, but it just got progressively weirder until in the, like, third and fourth season, his ghost father is living in a Canadian hunting lodge in the closet, like, in his closet at the Canadian consulate.
Yeah, he, like, opens a door.
And his father is there, like, in a whole...
providing advice or something?
Yeah, usually providing spirit guidance. And, yes, let's not forget his deaf wolf that reads lips. And,
it was just very strange.
Oh, and then at one point, they switch actors.
Oh, right. So the main guy, the sort of one of his sidekick
left after the first
season. And
Callum
Keith Rennie from Battlestar Galactica shows up.
And plays the replacement for his former partner. And it's just a wonderful example of a show that was, I think, really ahead of its time in terms of, like, self-awareness and that kind of tongue-in-cheek quality. Because this was still an era when actors would randomly get replaced on shows.
Yeah.
And so they were sort of making fun of the fact that he was still playing Ray,
the same character Ray,
except they had this whole conceit where Ray was in witness protection hiding, and so he was filling in, pretending to be
Ray. And so everyone around the Mountie was just acting as if nothing had changed, and the Mountie was like, am I going insane? Why is this random person
pretending to be my friend?
Yeah.
It was very strange and very bizarre, but that was a delightful show.
That was a delightful show, because I watched it when it was actually airing, back when I watched ridiculous 90s do-gooder shows.
The montages! I think there was one episode that managed to get 3 car chase montages.
And you discovered it when you came up to Canada.
I did. Well, I discovered it because one of my roommates, or one of my housemates, was really into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And she brought the DVDs with her. Mm. And that was when I discovered the DVDs were about 3 times as expensive in Canada as they were in the States, because no one in America cared about the show.
No.
Now,
when did you guys send them an invitation to Thanksgiving?
What?
Weren't you going to try to invite
the Mountie?
The Mountie to Thanksgiving? I feel like this was like...
That would be a really weird thing that we would have done in that era of my life.
I feel like you kept saying that that was something you were going to do. You were going to send him a
letter
possibly addressed to the Mountie.
I feel like that's one of those things that was much discussed and never put into action.
Oh, I should have asked him when I saw him.
You should have.
I should have been like, my wife and her strange friends.
We were very, very strange. Oh, that show. I binged on that show so much at one point.
Yeah.
Well, and it's like, and it was just a show that, like, the tone varied so dramatically from episode to episode. Like, the end of the first season is so intense and so dramatic, because it's like he fought, like, the Mountie, who has been this upstart, absolutely perfect man.
Yeah.
Encounters, like, the one woman he's ever been in love with, who was, like, she had been involved in a bank robbery, and he had chased her.
Ugh.
And
she was this Catwoman.
Yeah, she was like this Catwoman, and they'd had this incredibly impassioned affair while they were both waiting out a snowstorm, and then she escaped from him and was back in his life, and it was just like, and so you saw this guy like have this dark secret in his past, and but then it was just so Canadian.
It is incredibly Canadian. Sorry, I'm looking at this list of TV shows produced in Toronto, and I'm amazed at how much of this I actually watched a lot of in the 90s. Both The Pretender and Kung Fu The Legend Continues are showing up.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, if Time Tracks had been on this list as well, it probably was filmed in Vancouver, then that would have been like 90% of what I was watching in the 90s. Oh, man, I love The Pretender so much. Again, all these do-gooder shows that, like, were set in a big city, like, quote-unquote Chicago or New York. I don't know if... I have to assume no one ever tried to make L.A.
What does it say about the show that, like, the do-gooder is the embodiment of all things Canadian? Like, what message is that?
Well,
it's a particular kind of do-gooding, right? It's loyalty and earnestness and
absolute honesty.
And upsta- like, it's the... It's what I kind of love about Canada.
Yeah.
That I was sort of talking with my dad about this when we were this past week. That, you know, the American values are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Oh, right.
Right? And the Canadian values are peace, order, and good government.
Yeah, it does say that, a lot.
There's kind of a... There's no grandeur to the Mountie in a way. His heroism in that show is just his earnestness.
His civic-mindedness.
Civic-mindedness and his just... niceness.
Well, that's the thing, right? He's like sort of straight and well-ordered and civic-minded, and his partner is loud and obnoxious and wears tacky clothes and sort of thinks outside the box. And yeah. I guess that was supposed to be represent like America.
I think so.
In its strange ways.
It was a strange partnership, and yet they accomplished
so much together. It was also the 90s, so I guess I don't know. You didn't have first America's like shift to the right, and then Canada's shift to the right. You know. A few years later,
right,
as you know, things happen. So there was still that kind of, you know, optimism and like can do, like, well, we're strange and weird, but you know, we're getting it done.
But again, it's the particular kind of like can do, strange and weird,
yeah,
that I think that show embodies about Canada.
Very true.
A particular, they are the Canadian virtues, yeah. And I think in a good way.
Yeah,
I think there's much that can be learned
from the Mountie,
and being just. Good people.
Neat and able to not move when you're on duty at the consulate.
Because that was the other thing.
His partner would, like, come up and, like, relay important case information, and he would not respond at all until, like, the clock ticked over, and then he's like, all right, so what we need to do, blah, 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 blah. It was very strange.
Oh, I need to watch that show some more.
On this list, which is something straight from my childhood, is a very strange show, which I actually was talking about... I want to say on my horror podcast, talking about shows that freaked me out as a kid, and that's Today's Special.
Oh!
Today's Special really kind of troubled me as a child.
Wasn't it a kid's show?
It was a kid's show, but it all took place at a department store at night, and like at night this mannequin came to life, and there was a strange strange Muppets running around, and I don't know, there was something of like, I never felt very safe watching it. You know, you watch like Mr. Rogers, and you know, you feel like wrapped in like, you know, warm happiness. I watched this show and I felt on edge. I don't know what it says about me as a child. I'm sure if I watched it now, I'd be like, this is dumb and they have terrible 70s hair. But at the time, it really freaked me out. That's all I have about Today's Special.
I can't help you there. Thank you, Bilbo.
Thank you. Yes, if you Bilbo is back from his time at the little vet's kennel, so he's very excited and obviously noisy. We did acquire for him an R2-D2 collar.
We did.
Which luckily does not make any more noises than what are normally being made by his general shaking. So there you go.
So I guess the two things that we have to address in the filmed in Canada would be Suits and Hannibal.
Yeah, I mean, those are the ones that are happening right now. And I think those do a great job of juxtaposing how two different companies can use Toronto. Because Hannibal does a great, great, great job of hiding the Toronto, and Suits does not even care.
Yeah, it does not even try. Like I said, they don't even disguise the giant clock in the middle of the Royal York Hotel.
Yeah, Hannibal...
Hannibal does a great job because Hannibal does so much filming outside the Greater Toronto area.
Yeah, because they're in Oakville.
It does a lot of filming in Oakville. It has all the rural stuff, all of Will fishing.
Oh, yeah.
and everything. And it films at the U of T Scarborough campus.
Oh, okay.
That's why all of the buildings have that, like, kind of concrete-y look.
Okay, there we go. So that makes sense. So they're in Toronto, but sort of they've... kept away from the giant Bay Street stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are a few things that you can recognize from time to time.
But they Suits, use the, is just, Suits is absolutely ridiculous.
I think the Baltimore prison...
The asylum there?
Yes, the asylum for the criminally insane is hospital. That's the word I was looking for. Is the, like, observatory or something at the UT Scarborough campus?
Okay.
Or at least I know the observatory.
Well, again, there's all these sort of like great old buildings in Toronto that you can use. I mean, we have a castle, at least.
I'm pretty sure Castelloma showed up in the most recent episodes with the...
Well, most recent for us.
Well, the most recent for us, yes.
But yeah, I think, yeah, when they were going out to the Vergers, I think that was
Castelloma. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was Castelloma. So for those of you who are not aware, at one point in the 18th century, a crazy man with far too much money in Toronto built a castle.
Like you do.
I mean, a legitimate castle about 3 blocks from where we live.
Yes. Sort of right on the edge of a cliff. It was used in...
So we live kind of on the top... My church is on the hill.
Yes.
And we live right on the top of a sort of hill in Toronto. And at the top of this hill, a crazy man with too much money built a legitimate castle.
Well, Scott Pilgrim, they used that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Which is very... trying
to oh, get, that is well. We should talk about that. Well, that is super Toronto.
Well, the comic is set in Toronto. So,
yeah.
So I mean, it's Toronto on a couple of levels. But yes, using
because that talks about honest eds and anyway. So then he lost all of his money, and
like you do,
and lost the castle, and then it fell to the city, and ever since, for like the last century, the city has just been. Kind of like, we have this giant castle and we have no idea what to do with it.
So it's sort of a museum.
Yeah, it's partially events. A museum, partially special events, partially just...
Who wants to film in a castle?
Hey, we have a castle!
We've got stables.
The SCA meets there.
Oh, is that where they meet?
Yes.
Oh, there we go. That yes. makes too much sense.
But Suits is delightful because it really is the... You get to just kind of... I've been there. I know where that is.
Well, and they do the like big establishing shot, New York, sexy like skyline, and then Bay Street, and then they're on Bloor or they're on Queen. Yeah.
Or they're at the cathedral.
Or they're oh, that's right. That was amazing.
Specifically, the apartments at the cathedral. The uninhabited dean's residence is the sketchy lawyer's house.
Well, you know,
it's kind of delightful.
I guess it works. I don't know.
Yes. Anyway.
So those are the two right there. And next we wanted to kind of get into two shows that Rachel and I both watched some, although Rachel watched more of it. And those, not only were they filmed in Toronto, but they really...
They just capture some je ne sais quoi.
They have like a Toronto air about them. Like, they're set in Toronto, for one thing.
So one is Being Erica, which I don't think we have ever talked about on the show before.
No.
It doesn't really have anybody in it that anyone would know outside of Canada.
It's got the boyfriend from Wonderfalls.
Oh, it does have the boyfriend from Wonderfalls. That's right.
So there's that.
There's that.
Going for it.
Well, Wonderfalls we could also talk about. Wonderfalls was shot in Toronto. And Wonderfalls was great because it was set in Buffalo.
Although it's allegedly. Not listed here. I wonder if it was, I don't know.
No, it was because they shot at Union Station.
Oh, well, they made certain shots.
They definitely shot on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls.
Yeah, well,
definitely know they shot at Union Station.
Yeah.
And I mean, like they just have so many Canadian people in it, I'm sure. But maybe it wasn't like Toronto proper or something. I don't know.
Maybe it's just Niagara.
But like I said, I know they shot it at Union Station.
Yeah.
But Being Erica is as can-con as you can get.
Man.
I'm not even sure if it was ever aired outside of Canada, and it is, I mean, it's like, there is no place in Toronto that show does not eventually visit.
Apparently, it eventually went to SoapNet.
SoapNet. Okay, so the premise of Being Erica is that there is this 30-something, like, office worker temp girl who had great ambitions of being a novelist. But she's just kind of stuck in a dead-end job from which she actually ends up getting fired in the first episode. And, you know, she has an older sister who's a really promising medical resident, and her whole family is just kind of down on her, and she feels like her whole life is just crap because of all of these unfortunate decisions that she made. And then, so in the first episode, she kind of bottoms out, and she gets called into this mysterious psychiatrist's office, and it's a very and he's offering her a very peculiar kind of therapy where she is permitted to go back to points in her life which she felt were particular linchpins for her current state of unfortunateness, and then, you know, make the decision that she wished she could have made that will set her life on a better track. And what she eventually finds is that, you know, it's not so much fixing the decision, fixing that one particular moment doesn't ever necessarily make a difference.
Yeah.
It's not actually, oh, I'm going to go back. It's a very interesting kind of time travel Because it's not so much about, okay, I'm just going to go back and fix the past and then have to deal with the ramifications in the future to see how I messed with my past. Because really what she does in the past doesn't have any bearing on the future. It's all about changing her perspective.
Yeah.
On the future, which is very
interesting. Well, and when she does sort of mess with stuff in the past, doesn't that like always come back to like be an issue? Like with her boyfriend, the boyfriend figure and stuff like that?
I don't think so.
I feel like there was some issue where she kind of like messed with the relationship in the past. So like when she came to the present, like the relationship had ended. I don't know. I feel like I thought I saw some weird stuff like that.
Maybe. I don't. I feel like it was more about her altering her perspective. Yeah. Like learning from that experience, learning from that decision.
Well, she had a great one about like when she lost her virginity.
Yeah.
And how was this really kind of awful situation? And like she felt like, you know, she lost a lot of self-respect when it happened. And so she went back and she still lost her virginity.
Yeah.
But it was in a very different way. It was a much more sort of owned way and empowering way. And it just fit. You know, so I think that's the sort of thing you're thinking of.
So by the end of the series, she has kind of actually made a career for herself, actually become a much more confident person, and then becomes a therapist herself in her own right.
Yeah.
And so she begins to take on these clients in this kind of... And it's another one of these fascinating shows where you never really find out who's in control of this, how these therapists came into being. But yet it works.
Yeah, it works all the way.
And one of the really interesting things is she finds out in one of these episodes, because they start doing some, like, going to her future.
Oh,
and she finds out, she gets visited by one of her friends that she knew in therapy. Because it eventually comes to light that there are more people in these kinds of therapy sessions. And she starts to meet them and interact with them. And one of these people is from her future.
Oh, right.
Who's back in her present reliving one of these experiences. And he informs her that she will die in 2019 in an explosion at Union Station. And so then it becomes this interesting conversation about free will versus destiny and whether Erica can change her future or whether she should
accept it.
And it's kind of interesting how they eventually get around that.
Oh, yeah.
How they reconcile it. I mean, being a show that's not largely available outside of Canada.
No.
Unless it is somehow on American Netflix, but I'm not sure that it is.
It is on SoapNet, as we have
established. As we have established, yes. But I mean, it becomes this interesting idea of like multiple realities, right?
Yeah.
So that yes, there might be a reality in which she does die, in like 10 years,
mm-hmm.
but that might not be the only reality, and so to continue living as though multiple options are open to her. So I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment.
Indeed.
So, I don't know. As far as a time travel show goes, I think it does some interesting things because it's less concerned... It's more concerned with perspective on the past and less about using the past to change the future and getting into all of the timey-wimey nonsense.
Well, she's essentially her own personal quantum leap, right?
Yeah, basically. I think that's a really, really good way of explaining it.
Yeah.
But, and I think it does do some really interesting things with... you know, questions of redemption and questions of how you live through mistakes and how you rectify mistakes. And, you know, sometimes rectifying the mistake makes things worse. And
mm-hmm.
It's not like she suddenly makes everything easy for herself. I think she's able to improve herself based on her perspective and learning to accept herself as the flawed person that she is rather than just going back and getting an easy fix on all of these mistakes that she originally made.
My fun fact for the show is that a friend of mine who has written a few plays that I've been part of and I worked with in my bookstore, Stephen Neer, was a consultant on their LARPing
episode. Oh, he was, you're right. They did have a LARPing episode.
They had a whole episode about LARP, and I think they actually went to like one of Toronto's big LARPing locations, like big LARP clubs.
Yes.
But most importantly, he taught them how LARPers dance.
That's really funny.
But yes, that was a particularly interesting look at that whole...
But as far as Toronto goes...
Subculture.
It was crazy. Like, it hit everything in Toronto. I mean, right down to the fact that, like, she was living on Queen Street with her parents living in North York. And just for the record, like, everyone's parents live in North York.
That's what it feels like, yeah.
It is, like, that's just... how you do. And, you know, they got in the Toronto Jewish community because she was Jewish and her father was a rabbi.
Yeah.
And, you know, they did an episode where she went back to when she worked at the aforementioned Casa Loma. There was an episode where she went back to a summer that she worked at Black Creek Pioneer Village.
Oh, that's right.
which is the, like, living history museum in the north of the city. They had episodes where they went up to Cottage Country, because everyone goes up to Cottage Country in the summer. They had, like, they went back to her time as a student at U of T again and again and again. I mean, it was just, like, a friend of ours who moved out to Halifax for a year just would watch Being Erica because it just made her feel at home. She's like, it just makes me feel like I'm in Toronto.
It's so true.
Right down to her sister, like, once her sister kind of stops being so uptight and embraces, like, a new hippie lifestyle, having a home birth in the birthing pool.
Right.
With a midwife.
Yeah.
Because Toronto.
Yeah.
Oh, so it was just, that show is kind of, like, it's not a great show, but if it is on American Netflix, I would say it's worth checking out.
It's like a warm soup of a show.
It is a warm soup of a show. It's delightful and endearing. And, I mean, it has some worthwhile things to say, I think, about regret and past actions and perspective.
Well, it's funny. I once had a huge fantasy about, like, how, like, my, you know, ideal, like, heaven would be to be able to, like, go back through my life and, like, fix all mistakes and, like, you know, and sort of keep going through until, like, very quickly realized that would actually be hell. Because every time you fix something, something else would pop up and you would keep going back again and again.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of
again.
The point, right? Is that life is never perfect. We are never perfect. I mean, I think there is enough of a theological perspective one can pull out of it, right?
Sure.
I mean, it's certainly not a Christian show, but, I mean, an idea that we will never be perfect, life will never be perfect, but there is some onus on us to reconcile with our past and reconcile with our imperfections, mm-hmm. and I think we would say we do that through Christ.
Yeah.
And accepting our salvation and grace and forgiveness and all of that, and I think this show has a bit more of probably a bit of a secular humanist vibe to it, but
With strange magic,
but I think they're getting at something similar.
Sure, yeah. Also, you got to see the main actors dressed up as various ages, which...
Oh, yes.
They did a pretty good job, I feel, of...
I think they always did a good job of helping distinguish what era of her life she was in.
But if we want to talk about an actress having to portray...
Yes.
Many roles, many
okay,
looks.
Okay, so this really... The show we need to talk about is Orphan Black.
And we've been, like, trying to figure out what topic to cover with Orphan Black, because it really...
It touches on so many things.
I wanted to do sort of a bioethics
and
episode.
I didn't really want to get into bioethics.
Which we,
but,
yeah.
I will say a bit of a warning on this. I know that we have... of our tiny listening audience, I think there is probably a bit of a perspective of Christian attitudes towards questionable content
Indeed. In
media. And there are certainly things depicted in this show that are... There's a lot of sex on this show, let's just say that way.
It's a not safe for work environment. It Although, like, if people sat through our Hannibal episode...
It's true.
Although I guess this covers the standard, like, sex is more verboten than violence, so...
Yeah. But I was watching it, like, I was sitting in a coffee shop watching it on my iPad one day, and I was like...
Oh, dear.
I'll do this later. Because it's on cable in Canada, so...
That's right. Well, it's on Space, and I think it's on Sci-Fi, isn't it now?
I think it's on Sci-Fi now.
Yeah.
It was on BBC America at one point.
Oh, was it? Okay.
I think that was the American distributor.
Gotcha.
But if you could handle Game of Thrones...
Yeah, seriously.
Seriously.
It's not as bad.
Anyway, but just fair warning.
Beware.
One of the main characters is a male prostitute.
Indeed.
But I think you can argue, like, it's an interesting... you know, questioning of assumptions, right? Because that character in question is probably the most,
like, genuine
loyal,
and...
genuine, self-giving character on the show.
The male prostitute with the heart of gold to
Basically,
sort of slightly
to,
twist.
To slightly twist the convention, exactly, right? So if I think we've mentioned Orphan Black before, but I mean, the premise is there is the first scene... It's one of these, much like Game of Thrones, that began with George R. R. Martin going, I have an idea for a vignette about a man finding a litter of dire wolves that match his children. Six children.
Yeah.
And then a whole series spins out from that. The writers had this image of a woman walking down a train platform and seeing a woman take off her shoes and turn to look at her, and it's herself.
Yeah.
And then the woman throws herself in front of a train.
And that's how the show begins.
And so the first character in question is a grifter, a con artist, a kind of petty criminal.
A titular orphan.
Titular orphan. And so she, in just a moment of, what do I do? And like impulse, she grabs the woman's purse and runs off.
Yeah.
And so manages to then...
sort of take over her life in a weird way.
Take over her life, yeah.
Trying to sort of, like, see if she can, you know, rob her or, like, you know...
Because she finds out she has all this money in a bank account. And so really her goal is just to impersonate this woman long enough to get the money out of her bank account and run. And then in the process of doing this, she uncovers more doppelgangers and
finds out the woman's a cop and involved in all this other stuff and gets dragged into sort of very strange conspiracies and
eventually discovers that she and at this point about half a dozen other women are clones. And so it's the same actress who has to portray each of these clones.
Yeah.
And like seriously, I had heard that she was good, but oh my goodness, she is phenomenal. Like, I watch this show, and I forget that it's not an ensemble cast.
Yeah. No, it's pretty impressive.
And the scene, I mean, I think they're very, very judicious with having clones in scenes together.
Yeah.
But when they do, it's so well edited.
Well, and it won't just be, like, one or two. They'll have, like, three in a room.
I think I noticed it, one, like, they saved the three in a room for, like,
special.
The season finale.
Oh.
But they make it work because they all are kind of based in sort of different geographic
areas,
which I think helps with the accent.
Mm-hmm.
So she can put on a different accent for each clone, but then also gives legitimate reason why they can keep them apart and have them mostly communicating over Skype and things like that.
Also some very good wigs.
Very good wigs. But yeah.
But her body language for them is very different.
Well, what's impressive is not only can she play each clone, but then there will be scenes where the clones are impersonating another clone.
Yeah.
And even that is a distinctive performance.
Yeah.
Like, it's very clear that this is Allison pretending to be Sarah.
Yeah.
Or this is Sarah pretending to be Cosima.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, like, it's really, so it is worth watching for her performance alone.
And they are very, it is very set in Toronto. I mean, they will every now and then, you know, drop the name of, like,
various streets.
But it doesn't beat you over the head with it. Like, it's, you know, it's nice, it's there, but
it's like the opposite of Suits.
Yeah, well, I think it's similar to sort of how, you know, Suits and Being Erica are kind of in one area,
yeah,
and that they're very, very, very Toronto. And then this and Hannibal, I think, do a very good job.
Yeah. Ironically, Orphan Black is not supposed to be set in any particular city.
Yeah.
It's supposed to just be set in, like, fictional North American town. But it's so Toronto.
With colorful currency.
With colorful currency and a character who lives in Scarborough.
Yeah.
And I love, at one point, Felix, the aforementioned male prostitute, complains about having to go out to Scarberia.
No.
And I'm like, only people in Toronto call Scarborough Scarberia. Only people who live in Toronto watching this show will even get that reference.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, there you go.
Also has a Canadian icon, Matt Frewer, the mean dad from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Also Max Headroom.
Also Max Headroom.
He is Max Headroom, yes. But I mean, there's a lot going on. I mean, I think one thing I've read a lot about with this show, on the Lady Chains perspective, is that it's such a great example of a show with really dynamic women.
Yeah.
Like, women have all the agency and all the power in this show, and all of the men are basically useless. Well, I mean, that just digs into that whole stereotype of the only way to make women seem strong is to undercut the men. But I don't mean it like that. They're not idiots. They're the sidekicks. They are not the driving force of the action. It is a show about these women.
They are the companions, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. That basically every agent in the show is a woman.
Yeah.
Of some kind. It's a show of women interacting with women and whether it's positively or negatively.
Well, there's so many different types of relationships. It's not like they're all, you know, of the same type and of the same sort of rank. I mean, yeah. there's powerful power dynamics.
Well, and I think, yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's a very interesting perspective on what makes the quote unquote strong female character.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because there's Allison, for example, the suburban housewife clone is basically the darkest of all of them.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, is she a strong female character? Who, you know, she's the suburban housewife, which is the go-to derogatory thing.
Yeah.
If you want, not that I'm saying we should, that should be what it is. But I think the show does an interesting thing by taking this character who is, you start off thinking of as being useless.
Yeah.
Because, oh, she's just a stay-at-home mom. And then you kind of find out that she has this great capacity inside of her for, well, not good things, but...
very active things.
But to have... that there is a strength within her.
Yeah.
And so I think she is, in many ways, many people's favorite clone now.
Oh, yeah. In her relationship with Felix, I think
what's very interesting. So there's the main the sort of central character, the first one you meet, Sarah, who... is an orphan and has a foster brother named Felix.
Yeah.
And Felix is just, I mean, he is loyal to the core. His whole life is for Sarah and for her daughter.
Yeah.
And he would do anything for them and is just, in some ways, put upon
mm-hmm.
by her, but is just forthcoming with absolute patience. Well, it's so wonderful.
In the first few episodes when, you know, she's taken on this new life, and is trying to kill off her old self.
Yeah.
And he essentially has to arrange her funeral and yeah. like lie to everyone and
yeah.
and convince them all that he's really sad that she's gone.
Exactly.
And then he'll see her just be very, very put out.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's Allison, who Felix begins being completely disgusted with. Like, what do I have to do with this woman from the suburbs who's more interested in taking her kids to soccer and yoga than anything else in her craft room? But eventually, like, he and Allison develop this incredibly close relationship. And I think by this point in the show, it's fair to say that he and Allison are closer than he and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
It's I don't know, it's just a really, really cool, very dynamic characters, which is interesting considering that, like, half a dozen of them are all played by the same person.
Yeah, a friend of mine was really hoping to see her, I think, at either the Emmys.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was hoping to see the actress, you know, as
that was
Various.
At the Golden Globes.
Oh, Golden Globes.
She was actually listed as Various.
As Various.
And I think with the sexual... I mean, it is a show that is very, very sexual, but I think they actually do some very interesting things. I mean, you see very explicit sex.
Yeah.
And it is not all heterosexual.
No.
And then you have what would seem to be a very...
traditional.
Yeah, but like, it's a scene where a man is basically raped by one of the clones.
See.
I mean, effectively.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's you know, this sort of goes to your fascination / horror with the men's rights movement.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That would say you never see sexual violence depicted against men
yeah.
or that we are. But I mean, I think it's very interesting to see examples in media where you do see sexual
yeah.
violence against men and how problematic that is. And like, I think Farscape is another interesting example where in the fourth season of Farscape, John Crichton is essentially raped.
Yeah.
By Commandant Grazer. And I don't know. I just think it's very interesting when a show or something in media can be bold enough to take that step and show, you know, female empowerment is not an unqualified good. I guess that's what I'm kind of getting
okay,
at.
Okay, no, I get that.
Is that you know, it's just because these are strong women doesn't make them good women.
Yes. Well, and good
and
storytelling, I think,
and good storytelling,
that, right?
And I think that's what is interesting to me is that we can only to only show good empowered female characters is not honest towards women.
No. Well, and that's patronizing and pandering, right?
Exactly. That women can be. Can be villainous too, but again, be villainous. Like the character that does this is not unsympathetic.
No.
and she is acting out of her own pain.
But it's still problematic.
It's still incredibly wrong, and she's still the bad guy. Yeah. But so, I mean, it's a show that takes many interesting risks and does very, very, very interesting things. And then there is a whole religious aspect to it.
Oh, right.
Because it is a show about cloning, and one of the major subplots is, in the first season, the kind of go-to villain in the first season is one of the clones who's gone insane.
Yes.
And as you find out, she was given over to the church, and she eventually got raised by a anti-clone nutjobs.
Yeah.
Who convinced her that she is an abomination, as are all of the other clones.
And she needs to...
She's like the one exception. Like, she's special for some reason. And she needs to hunt down and destroy all of these abominations. So, because only by doing that can she be
cleansed.
Be cleansed, right.
Also, she's like creepy and Russian, which helps.
Well, Ukrainian.
Oh, excuse me.
You don't want to make that mistake these days.
Very true.
And then she becomes an absolutely fascinating character, right? Like, it's a very good show. I think it's that question, right? Of where do you come? I mean, this is why you wanted to get into a bioethics conversation.
Precisely.
But where do we come down on this? You know, do we see these as people? If you don't see them as people, does that mean that they are abominations?
Or does that mean they can be used? I mean, that's the real issue with cloning, right?
Well, and that's the question that comes up at the end of the first season.
Yeah.
Are these people that you've come to know, are they just property of a corporation?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they people of their own right? How much agency do they have? And I think that's what I've heard it read about in feminist terms, and that's what feminists are very interested in with the show, is that it is a show about women's bodies.
Oh,
and
right.
Who owns their body? Do they own their body, or does this corporation own their body?
Okay.
And so it that's very much, that's not even subtext, it is text, right? It's a show that raises very interesting questions and goes in a lot of different places.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's, you know, I think when it comes to bioethics, I think that's part of the conversation we can have, right? The people in the show who are sort of in control of the whole cloning experiment are these neolutionists.
Oh, I see.
Who are trying to control human evolution and trying to, you know,
move us in a new direction.
Yeah. And I think if we think of ourselves as created beings, that is the sin, right?
Yeah.
And in some ways, that is original sin.
Oh, yeah.
That desire to create ourselves apart from God.
Well, that's the whole issue that we see with the singularity movement and kind of like how do we move evolution forward? And is it, you know, it gets into very weird, you know, commodification issues and class issues, you know, like can only the rich truly be evolved,
yeah.
And will they then become the new humans? I mean, I think it's fascinating. It's why, I mean, I think eventually we can have an interesting discussion, you know, especially with all the Lewis McMaster Bujold we read.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I've enjoyed what I've seen of the show. I haven't watched
What I like is that neither it's, you know, the religious extremists are portrayed as crazy and terrible, but so are the science extremists.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're the ones trying to control these clones and these women and think that these creations that they have made are their property.
Well, they're able to, both sides are able to strip away the humanity.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I think on the whole, I would say that the real strength of the show is Tatiana Maslany's, I think that's her name.
Yeah.
Her performance is the strength of the show. The relationships between the characters and how they play the clones off of each other. Not so much the science fiction. I think at times it can be very heavy-handed.
Okay.
But it is a good show. It is really worth checking out. It's the first season is only 10 episodes, but they are 10 very intense episodes. You will see things done in a craft room that...
Shouldn't be done.
Should not be done in a craft room. And it's dark, but I think it's worth watching. And I think the weird Toronto-ness is just in that, I don't know.
Well, it's a flavoring, right?
It gives
everything a texture in an interesting way. I mean, because they don't really hide it, but they don't go out of their way to highlight it. You just get this. And again, that's what I got when I was watching it. I was like, there's just
something about this that feels Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. All the good governance.
Yes.
And there we go. Yes. I think until we get our Rob and Doug Ford wacky misadventures, we fight crime or we are crime, you know.
That's our perspective on Toronto having just come back from the States.
Indeed.
Our eyes open to our Canadian homeland. The true North, strong and free.
That is us.
We just need to go eat some Kraft dinner.
I have a Kraft dinner.
You have Kraft dinner?
We have Kraft dinner. I had some before we left.
Oh, okay.
So we have a Kraft dinner. Right, a Kraft dinner is what Canadians call macaroni or Kraft macaroni and cheese. It's just known as Kraft dinner. We don't pretend to understand.
In fact,
why.
The non-Kraft version is still Kraft dinner.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's like I want off-brand Kraft dinner.
Oh, it's very strange. But we love
our attempt to stop at a Tim Hortons on the way back was thwarted.
It was thwarted.
There
but
were no chairs.
We do get to now have a lot of fun of handing over our two American and one Canadian passport when
it's
we cross
true.
The border.
It's true.
Our little anchor baby.
With her
giant's emblem of the Canada right there on the passport makes us feel like we're truly home. So that's it for us. We'll be back in 2 weeks, hopefully. And if you haven't checked out the fun roundtable episode from Crossover Nexus, please do. It's a lot of fun. There is a very wide range of opinions present, but it was an honor to be a part of that. And we're excited to do more. And we will let you know when that happens. And so, from the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order, and I do apologize for missing this last time. Geek out, y'all.
So many ways to say I love you, in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you, as only a true geek can.
Ich liebe dich is German, geeky for the board games, in Latin and in Spanish it is te amo. Mi alina fina is the phrase in Toki Po, na me amas fin in Esperanto.
Lean on a malafine. In Sindarin means I sing because I love you.
Aggie Oogie is what you type
for a lion and a whore to talk to.
To stick with Elvish, we have Che Melane, yet another language that Tolkien made. Ustan, Sindrik, Ilta, spoken in Drowish, a D&D type of elf you played.
I love you, I would date with you by Tatawaki Kuno. Not a different language, but it's good enough. Hato Daisuki is Japanese bagiki, cause the Taku really love their weird stuff.
Eep, off, pork,
from Saturday morning cartoons.
Ie of Leu, yay.
From way back when I was in grade 2.
Wana Rayana Roaisha in Vulcan, and Klingon it's Kapa, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset.
Nikartele Gardarasim is Mandalorian, in and out of galaxy long gone by. If you speak Hatties, you say Umaji Muna on Dagobah. It's
love you, do I?
10 print, I love you, 20 go to 10,
my first program as a child.
I pointer method love parameter you.
I bet your hormones are going wild.
You can have love, K, thanks, bye.
I display lolcat finery.
I less than 3 you and
01101011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011
without spaces.